You're listening to The Space Show with Andrew Rennie. Australia has a long history in tracking satellites, manned spacecraft and probes to the moon and planets. One of these tracking stations was located at Honeysuckle Creek, deep within the Brindabella Ranges to the southwest of Canberra. It was opened in, I've forgotten the year, and closed in 1981 December. During its time, it supported the Apollo manned lunar missions, the Skylab space station, and numerous unmanned missions. The two most imposing structures were the 26-metre diameter antenna dish and a huge control and operations building. Recently, the space show travelled up to Canberra. With two of the former staff members, we took an hour-long drive out to Honeysuckle Creek. The area is now a national park. All that remains of this once proud structure is a large concrete slab and some historic signs to remind picnickers of what once happened here. As we fossicked around the area looking for telltale signs of the station, I chatted with John Saxon.
Sure, my name's John Saxon, and we're currently at the site of the Honeysuckle Creek tracking station, which was purpose-built for manned space flight and in particular for the lunar phases of the Apollo missions. And I was incredibly lucky to work here for 13 years, sitting on the ops console, conducting the band, and it was a really incredibly lucky event that I was in the right place at the right time to get that job. I went on after that for 15 years at the Canberra Deep Space Station, at Toobimbilla, and then a couple of years, 3 years at Jet Propulsion Laboratory Consulting over there. So in all, I spent about 32 years in the tracking business. And at Honeysuckle here, this was, I think everybody comes up here realises it is a beautiful site. It's surrounded by quite high hills, which surprises some people because they think it would inhibit the signal too much. But, of course, we didn't pick it up until the spacecraft was over the hills, but it's surprisingly lower than you'd imagine when you look around here. I think the highest hill here would be maybe 10 degrees elevation from here. It doesn't look like that, but that's true. And so, yes, we had an 80-foot, 85-foot, 26-metre antenna here, which was very fast. Mover, fast accelerating machine, and it was capable of tracking the re-entry phases of the lunar missions, which came in at 36,000 miles an hour or something. We had a thriving community up here. It was totally self-contained. We had carpenter shops, mechanics workshops, air conditioning workshops, cooks, cleaners, cafeteria people, all the way through to the management, and then, you know, all the technicians and operators and engineers who work the equipment during the missions. And I suppose during Apollo we would have had shifts of about up to 20 people, I suspect. When we went to Skylab, we got a whole lot of extra equipment, and so we ended up with about 30 people on a shift. During Apollo missions, of course, they were spread out a little bit, although it was pretty frantic. We used to get the documentation for a mission before we tracked the previous mission. It was pretty frantic. The pace was enormously high, but during the Apollo period, we did work up here, you know, 24/7 during the missions, but then in between missions we could take some time off and do engineering changes and a whole lot of other stuff. But then when you came to Skylab, that was 24/7 continuously for several years, and that was a great series of missions to support. I really probably enjoyed Skylab more than I enjoyed Apollo, to be honest.
Yes, because the Apollo missions lasted a bit over a week, whereas the Skylab was up to 84 days for the longest one.
Well, the manned period was, but it was still being tracked, and a lot of things were happening on the spacecraft, experiments and things of that sort in the unmanned period. So it was a continuous support for the entire period of the Skylab was up there. And yeah, it was a great time. And after the Skylab missions, we supported Apollo Soyuz for a while, and then after that it became a deep space station up here. And then we were lucky enough to support Viking missions to Mars, the launches and early flights, early encounters of the Voyager spacecraft, Pioneer 6 through 10 and 11, and Helios, just a whole swag of missions we used to support from here.
Yeah, Helios was the mission that orbited the Sun.
That's right, yes. It was a very interesting mission because at certain parts of its orbit it was only visible from the Southern Hemisphere, so we were the only site that could see it. And there was a great emphasis on the reliability of these stations up here because being the only station in the Southern Hemisphere of this size, of the 26-meter antenna, if we had been read for some reason that we couldn't support the spacecraft, they wouldn't have launched. It was that simple. So before an Apollo mission, you know, we had to be all prepared and ready to go.
So what happened to the station in the end?
Unfortunately, what happened in 1981... we closed down, and I was lucky enough to move over to Canberra Deep Space Station and work there for a longer period. But it took a while to strip the equipment out, but eventually everybody just shut up shop and walked out. And then after a while, the ACT government decided that they weren't going to pay for any sort of security arrangements up here. And that's when the vandalism started. And the vandals came in and they literally sledgehammered down walls and took out all the copper piping and the copper cables that they could find and just about everything they could rip out of the place.
I was with John Saxon at Honeysuckle Creek. Now, as so often happens with folks who grew up in the days of British imperial measurements, in the rush of an interview, John mixed units. The re-entry speed of the Apollo spacecraft when returning to the moon was approximately 36,000 kilometres per hour, not miles per hour. Now, during his 13 years at Honeysuckle Creek, John did numerous jobs, many at the operations console. Now, Hamish Lindsay was a member of the technical staff from 1966 to 1981. During that time, the two formed a friendship. This was very much in evidence as we walked around the site sharing memories of what they considered to be the highlight of their career. The 26-metre diameter dish at Honeysuckle Creek could be pointed in any direction from the all the way from the horizon to the zenith, that means directly overhead. To cope with the movement of satellites across the sky, it had to be able to tilt at up to 3 degrees per second. Now, this was quite an engineering feat. When the antenna was moved for the first time, all eyes were peeled for trouble. Was the gearing right? Were the motors strong enough to move the huge antenna? Were the clearances between the dish and the nearby structures wide enough? Or would the dish hit something? Now, Hamish Lindsay still remembers that day.
They posted people all over because they didn't know what it was going to hit. And the first time that it was ever moved, and then they rolled it round and we were all watching to see if it was going to hit anything at all. And then as we were watching, and he tilted it over, a drill fell out and whacked down out of the little TV room, fell down, hit the cord caught on something, and then went whack and swung around. And we thought, thank God nobody was underneath it.
On occasions, technicians had to go up onto the antenna. At such times, the antenna was not supposed to move. As we wandered around the spot where the antenna once stood, Hamish told of one occasion where the safety rules were breached. As you will hear, John Saxon doesn't quite believe him.
I had an experience with the antenna when we were up here. I was going up there to take some reading beers, to take readings before every pass, and you'd have to put a board to say that you're up there, not to move anything.
Yeah.
And so I did that. I was up there, and I was taking a reading, and suddenly the antenna started to tear off to the coal tower, started to rip off, and I didn't know what was going to happen, because nobody's supposed to be up there when it's rolling. And the strange bit of drawers flew open, and I had the clipboard went flying down, and what became of the floor, well, became the wall, and the phone went down to the floor, which was up there, because everything was tilting over. And I was hanging on to a pipe, with my feet dangling in the air, cursing them, whoever was down
there.
Come
on, this never happened.
It did. You asked Tony Salvage, because he came along, and they were panicked. They thought, hey, Hamish is up there. You asked Tony Salvage.
Yeah, why did they do it? Because the clip going over the servo console, you couldn't turn the servo console.
Paul Elkabat thought I was down. He took it off.
Oh, right.
I'll tell you it happened. You asked Tony Salvage.
I'm joking, mate. I'm sure that happened.
I tell you, I thought, I'm going to have a rough time up there. I don't know what was going to happen. There's me hanging onto this pipe beam, and finally my feet dangling on the floor, and the phone was down on the floor. I couldn't even get to it until it stopped.
Yeah, that must have been fun.
The manned Apollo missions to the moon were preceded by unmanned ones. The first American probes were the Rangers. After some failures, they finally succeeded in sending back a stream of pictures as they made a depth dive into the lunar surface. The surveyors that followed them made soft landings on the moon and sent back thousands of pictures of the lunar surface. These proved once and for all that the moon's surface was strong enough to support a spacecraft. One problem remained. Where should the Apollo lunar modules land? To help inform this decision, a series of five spacecraft were placed into orbit around the moon. They conducted a detailed photographic mapping of much of the lunar surface. That's where the new tracking station at Honeysuckle Creek came in. It had to pick up the weak radio signal coming from this tiny spacecraft as it circled the moon every 2 hours. But where to point this new antenna? John Saxon shared with the Space Show this anecdote on how this was done.
Well, there was a famous story of Ian Anderson, wasn't there? When the very first Predix they sent us to track lunar orbit around the moon, to give us a bit of a heads up about tracking, were actually for a 30-foot site in the Northern Hemisphere. So we desperately wanted to track this spacecraft, so we thought, well, if we point at the moon, we'll be able to lock onto a lunar orbiter. Unfortunately, so we put this Scottish guy called Ian Anderson up in the antenna to look down the bore side of the antenna and guide the operator onto the moon. Now, the problem was that it's an XY antenna. It doesn't follow any rules that you can imagine. And I never forget hearing Ian's talking about that. Up a bit, up a bit, up a bit. And you can't just go up a bit. You've got to do a bit of X and a bit of Y, haven't you?
Yeah.
And anyhow...
You've got a ball to do that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. Up a bit, up a bit. It's so close it hurts. I always remember that. It's so close it hurts. He had a pair of binoculars looking at them.
Now, if you're smart, you don't fire off a probe or manned spacecraft to the moon and trust to luck that a bunch of Aussies will be able to successfully track it. Pointing the antenna even a fraction of a degree in the wrong direction would mean no pictures or data received. Without second chances, tens of millions of dollars spent on the spacecraft would have been wasted. The answer is to rehearse, rehearse, and rehearse. But with what? Aircraft were flown near the antenna. They broadcast a radio signal to simulate the one that would later be sent by the actual spacecraft. These aircraft had navigation lights and other lights, which, in the dark skies above the Brindabella Ranges, were visible for quite some distance away. At a time when stories of flying saucers were rife, you can guess what happened. Hamish and John thought this was quite funny.
And there was another case where when we were doing simulation, the aircraft were flying around because we couldn't have any Predix because the aircraft was flying. Yeah. And we couldn't find this
aircraft. We had an IP point.
And we had Ian Anderson again pointing where the aircraft was. We were trying to follow his finger.
Well, it was very difficult to start with. Yes. Tracking aircraft is difficult with a big antenna, no question about it. But they had IP points, you know, they were flying a predetermined track, and they had to be in the right place at the right time, in theory, and we should be able to intercept them, but it was damn hard, wasn't it?
In the early days, it was almost impossible. We had a lot of trouble in the early days before we got... In those days, we hardly knew how to drive the antenna because it was all new to us.
Yeah,
and they used to have people all over the place. Their server had two people, the receivers had a string of people, there were people taking notes. And then they thought, we don't need all these people, really. But we started off with a large crowd of people doing things. Every position had about two people on it.
Yes.
Because they didn't know what was coming. And then got into it, we discovered we didn't need all these people.
We used to produce all these charts, and we used to lay them all out in the corridor, try and find out what the error rates were in this direction and that direction and so on. But the sim aircraft used to come... Well, I can't remember which direction they came from, but they used to fly up and down this Brindabella range. And at night, they used to have a big light on them. And so the police used to get a million calls, you know, aliens are coming, you know.
UFOs.
Lights looking up over the hills, yes. Mm.
Because there was this light going backwards and forwards. You would think it was an alien because this light was going back. It wasn't going anywhere doing anything, it just going backwards and forwards.
Mm.
Most of the work at Honeysuckle Creek was serious, requiring concentration and dedication to the task. Mostly. But not always.
I have to say that the simulations were infinitely harder than the real missions.
More fun, too. Because we knew it wasn't a spacecraft.
I don't know about fun. I had a guy who actually... I pulled a module out of the microwave equipment, and this guy, who now works at JPL... was having his dinner, so I pulled this module out, and then somebody paged him to say that it was a problem with the microwave. He came up and eventually found out what I'd done, and he got me up against the wall and he was going to fill me in, and then I had to share a car with him going home, you know. Infantile tricks.
The task of simulations is to not only prepare for the expected or planned events, it also prepares you for the unexpected. In that respect, simulations can be more stressful than a real mission.
And everybody had to keep going, even though, but they had to do all the right things with whatever cropped up. So when a real mission came along, it really wasn't too hard. Apollo 11 wasn't too hard at all. It was only when we got to 13 we started to get stressed.
Inevitably, in high technology endeavours, things don't always go according to plan. A component in a tracking station's back room may fail. You can't yell out, "Hang on a mo, mate." The spacecraft will continue on oblivious to your plight. Hamish Lindsay was often the one who, at Honeysuckle Creek, had to jump to it to fix things. To alter a phrase from show business, the mission must go on.
In one of those simulations, they came to me and said to the time standard, "That card's failed. Get another one."
There
came a stopwatch, and I had to rush off to the store, and I had so long to get the spare part and get it in. It was all done with a stopwatch.
Time to give it to you, too. They had to find it, too.
Yeah.
But, they were fun times for simulations.
They crawl under the floor and pull a plug out and watch to see how long it...
When the Honeysuckle Creek tracking station was first built, access was via a dirt road. The journey from Canberra used to take up to 3 hours if the weather was bad. Even after the road was sealed, Canberra was an hour's drive away. Inevitably, a medical emergency would arise. This was even harder to manage if a space mission was being tracked, as John Saxon recalls.
Did a very, very good imitation of a heart attack in the middle of the telemetry area.
Well, only Laurie could do that.
Yeah, only Laurie could do that. And the idea was, of course, that he had to be carried out on a stretcher and everything used to carry on as if nothing had happened. You know, we still had to do all the stuff.
Peters Timber and Hardware Brighton and Caulfield is your one-stop shop for all your timber, plumbing and hardware needs. Speak to the experts and friendly staff at Peters Timber and Hardware if you're renovating your home. And they also have exclusive paint and match colour system for all interior and exterior jobs. Peters Timber and Hardware Brighton and Caulfield is open 7 days a week in New Street Brighton and Normanby Street Caulfield. Peter's Timber and Hardware, Brighton and Caulfield, is a proud sponsor of 88.3 Southern FM.
Now, today, it's a beautiful drive out to Honeysuckle Creek. First through the ever-spreading suburbs of Canberra, then through rolling hills of farmland. The road reaches to Brindabella and begins a winding ascent through delightful bushland. We catch the occasional glimpse back down the forest-clad steep valley to the farmland below. Rocky cliffs hang threateningly above us. The route to the tracking station has always been very scenic, but was not, in the early days, as easy to negotiate. Jim Kirkpatrick is a former engineer who worked there for many years. The space show met him at Tidbinbilla Deep Space Communications Complex. He shared with us an anecdote about getting to work after a rockfall on the road. Back with Jim. You've got an interesting story about the opening of Honeysuckle Creek, is that right?
No, well, it wasn't the opening. It's quite a few years after. When I went to Honeysuckle, it had been under construction for several months then, but we still used an old dirt track, and in fact, it wasn't unusual. We always kept our wellings in the back of the car, and it wasn't unusual to get out and have to push the car up the hill. Sometimes after a lot of rain, we even had to use a couple of four-wheel drives. We'd drive the car to the bottom of the hill, which is quite a steep hill, and we were using just an old farmer's dirt track, and quite often we used to drive the car to the bottom of the hill and use four-wheel drives to transport the staff back and forward. Well, building the road was quite a feat. It was virtually carved out of the side of the hill, and it was quite a steep valley that the hill fell away to. And I can vividly remember, probably a couple of years after the station opened, between two shift cars, about 100 metres of cliff, 100 metres of road, fell down the cliff into the valley. And of course, all the staff were in the station, and luckily, the road slipped away between two of the shift cars. One got past, the road fell away, and then one of the other shift cars was on the other side. But it was all the staff, and most of the cars were at the station side. So a few of us had to dig a footpath over where the road had slipped away, ferry the staff down to the breakaway in the station cars, lead them in single file across this little path we dug, and then we hired buses to get the staff up to all the staff back to town. Of course, now we're faced the problem. All the staff are home, all the cars are in the station. So we had an emergency meeting that night, and the department contacted the farmer, and we obtained permission from the farmer to use the old road, because we knew that repairing the breakaway would be a long task. So we got permission from the farmer to use the old track, and about half a dozen of us. Luckily, we had about half a dozen cars in town, so we filled the cars with four people in each car, drove up the old track to the station, and brought all the cars back that afternoon and dropped them at various houses so people could get to work on the Monday. And in the meantime, of course, it took quite some time before they were able to reconstitute the road by cutting further into the hill.
So
John will show you that when you go fast. John will show you when you get that when you go fast tomorrow.
Oh, thank you very much. This could well have been a tragedy rather than an amusing story. Yeah,
well, it could have been a tragedy, but luckily there was no real problem, just a bit of inconvenience for several people, and then we had to use the old road for a while, and the farmer was quite happy for to use the old road until the other road was opened.
Well, thanks, Jim, for joining us on the Space Show.
I'll ask John to show you that.
That's Jim Kirkpatrick. Now, the Space Show has met many of the folks that worked at the Honeysuckle Creek tracking station. They share at least one characteristic in common: an intense pride in what was achieved during the 1960s and 1970s. In Canberra, we met Bill Meyer. Now, his task at Honeysuckle Creek was as a data decoder. He and his colleague, Neil, shared their experiences with us as we ate in the noisy cafeteria of the National Science and Technology Centre on the shores of Lake Burley Griffin.
Phil Meyer? Phil Mayer.
Phil Mayer. Welcome to the Space Show, Phil. What was your job here in Canberra?
Well, my job was at the Honeysuckle Creek Shaking Station most of the time. I got there in February 73, just before the start of the Skylab missions. And it was all very and totally new environment to me at the time. It took me several months to feel as though I was a part of it. But, I worked in the data section, which were the specialised computers that handled the data that came out of the RF section. And our job was to decode the data and also to record it on tapes and other equipment. One of the highlights that I remember was that these big computers, we called them DCOMs, had rows of lights on front of it. You could actually dial up memory locations and watch the data change. And one of the chaps on my shift was watching a particular couple of words in memory as the Skylab spacecraft launch came over the hill. And within a few seconds, he was able to tell us and operations that the solar panel wings on the Skylab had not deployed. And because of that, our station, or Honeysuckle, was able to tell Houston that they had a problem long before they, well, maybe slightly before they would have picked it up themselves. And it was... I spent 12, 18 months there working on Skylab in the aftermath, and it was probably the highlight of my working career. It was exciting, it was fulfilling. You always knew you were there for a purpose. And, it's...
The three Skylab missions, I think that was 28 days, 54 and 84 days, and so something of that sort.
Sounds about right, yep.
Were you in contact with Skylab daily?
Yes, we'd normally have about five or six, maybe more, passes every day. The pass would only last about 10 minutes but in the time the spacecraft went from horizon to horizon, because it was in a relatively low Earth orbit. But we'd have five or six of those every day, and we might get two or three on a shift, or maybe more. I forget the exact numbers now. But so we'd have to prepare for the pass, check the data, process the data as it was coming down from the spacecraft. Then after the pass, we'd have to reprocess a lot of the data to get more information, because we'd record the data on tape as it was going over, and then turn around and prepare for the next pass. And all wrapped around all of this, we'd have the normal maintenance and configuration of the shaking station itself, because all the time there was equipment being upgraded, added to, taken out. It was very rarely a quiet time at the station.
Never a dull moment.
No.
After Skylab ceased being occupied, it continued in orbit for some years. Did you continue tracking it at that stage and collecting data and telemetry from it?
Not sure about that. I can't remember. But I think we tracked it for a couple of months anyway. They were still conducting experiments in the spacecraft. Remotely. Then we ceased operations on Skylab and then reconfigured to a deep space station, DSN network.
So you weren't still tracking Skylab in its final orbits before it came back down to Earth?
No, it stayed up there for several years. A lot longer than anyone anticipated, I think. And so Honeysuckle had long been a DSN station by the time that Skylab finally came down.
So as a DSN, what sort of craft were you tracking then, and what was your role in tracking?
Our role was to very similar to Skylab, except that the pass would last anywhere from 6 to 13 hours, depending on how far out the spacecraft was and the specific geometry. But it was a very quiet life compared with the manned spaceflight network, because to do a pass, you'd spend an hour or two setting up the equipment, getting it all running. You'd lock onto the spacecraft, and then for the next 8, 12 hours, the whole thing would just be automated. So you'd sit there watching grey paint and flashing lights.
Yeah, basically tracking most of the spacecraft in interplanetary space.
Yes.
So most of the spacecraft would be interplanetary space, so you'd be like tracking a planet across the sky.
Exactly, yep. There were the older ones like Pioneers 10 and 11, then Vikings, and Voyager was a big one for us. And most of the time, as Neil said, because we had a fast-moving antenna, we could also support the launches.
Yes. So I heard a comment some years ago that it might not be possible to track Voyager, not so much because the signal's gotten too weak for us to detect, but because the equipment changes mean that you no longer can latch onto the frequencies and get the right the telemetry.
This may be the case, but I've been out of the system for nearly 25 years now, so certainly the equipment's moved on, but I'm sure with the computing power, the sophisticated computers these days, they'd easily be able to write any software they needed to process the signal. But
even the RF sections are digitised now. They come back from the antenna. They used to come down as an IF signal at 50 megs or so. Now they digitise them up the front and send it back as digital data.
And Phil, what's perhaps your favourite memory of your time tracking spacecraft?
Well, my favourite memory, now this may, and I think there's a high chance it's urban myth, but in the early days of Honeysuckle, I was told by very honest and reliable people that we were tracking a spacecraft one day, and all of a sudden the antenna shut down because there were big safety switches all over the antenna in case anyone accidentally got caught up there and the antenna started moving. Well, anyway, the antenna shut down, and after 10 minutes or so, no one could find a reason for it. So Houston were getting a bit excited, so we brought it up and locked back onto the spacecraft. 20 minutes later, it shut down again. Now, bells and whistles going off. This happened 3 or 4 times, I've been reliably told. And then eventually one of the gardeners wandered in and he said, "I've been watching the antenna up there and there's a couple of cockatoos sitting up there, perched up there. And as the antenna tilts over, I notice they reach over and hit the big red button up there." Well, that was a bit of a laugh anyway, but this reliable friend of mine, tells me the biggest problem was trying to convince the Americans that it was some galah up in the antenna causing all the trouble.
There was another incident too. We had the transmitters we had were ex-Navy, well, Navy design, and they were all waterproofed and sealed, and so the heat exchange, they blew hot air up a shield. And they had quite big fans, several, about 4 quite big noisy fans, and they had airflow switches on them. The transmitter would shut down, wait a few minutes, and come back up again. You could bring it back up. This happened several times, and we discovered what was happening, that the bogon moths were sheltering inside the airflow. And when the fan started up, it sucked them up and they hit one of the airflow switches and tripped the transmitter off. And so the fault report was, shut down due to bogon moths. And, of course, then they wanted to know what a bogon moth was and how it got there. And so we had to put gauze over. We just put a bit of gauze over and, that took us a while to find that one.
Well, thanks for joining us on the Space Show, Phil.
It's been a pleasure.
And Neil, thank you.
Yes, a pleasure also. Yeah, happy to be of assistance.
I was talking there with Bill Meyer and Neil Pollard, data decoders at the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station, and I was speaking with them in Canberra. So, here we are back at the Honeysuckle Creek Tracking Station, well, the site of the former station, because it's now gone. It's now a campground and a picturesque picnic spot nestled in a valley between bush-clad hills and the Brindabella Ranges. I'm standing on the concrete slab on which stood the multi-story operations room. Down the hill are the remains of a concrete bunker that housed diesel storage tanks. The diesel was used to run electrical generators that power the energy-hungry electrical equipment. It had to be trucked in from Canberra, that is the diesel, and there was no mains electricity here. Up a small rise is a level spot that housed the 26-metre steerable dish antenna. There are few people on this planet who have not seen the television that came back from the moon through that dish. But it's gone now. Moved to Tidbinbilla in the early 1980s. So go there to Tidbinbilla if you want to see it. But come here if you want to fully appreciate Honeysuckle Creek and its contribution to space exploration. There is a time capsule buried here. A future generation will open it. John Saxon knows what it contains, but the autumn afternoon breeze picked up as he related its story.
They were fun times.
Up to the last minute, and then what's the panic as we
do all the stuff. By this magnificent, lots of good stuff.
So perhaps our younger listeners will travel out to Honeysuckle Creek for the capsule's recovery and opening. I'm Andrew Rennie.
For local news and views and the greatest variety of music, this is Southern FM. 88.3.